got to advertise the sponsors. Here's a one of the newsletters, but we used to have Rio items. When I first went to Rio, Cy Rath was quite active. Did you?
Did anybody know that? Yes.
All right, and he had an awful lot of memorabilia. You know, he was personnel director. Wait a while ago. He wasn't when I went. He was in the parts cost department downstairs with Art Hempstead and so forth. And of course, there I'm getting Eager Beaver Award there.
What was the Eager Beaver Award?
Well, it's a sort of a little silver. It's made of pewter, but it was silver plated, and it was an Eager Beaver. Maybe they're showing it someplace. Of course, I didn't get to bring this in. I just showed you what. Then they had what they call a Golden Broom Award for the foreman out in the shop for keeping their places clean and all that. But you got to look at all these, and then Bob Block, he was down in the cost accounting, and a few others of the. You're going to be able to have that.
Oh,
too.
Wonderful.
Here's Zenon Hansen herself.
These will be nice artifacts.
And who's this here? This person?
And Zenon Hansen.
Okay.
And this is just another one. And here's Capper myself.
Oh, Capper.
Oh,
we heard a lot about him.
Yeah,
we
sure well, I don't think you heard too many good things about him in general, but then.
F.L. Capper. Was his first name Frank?
No. No, I don't
know. It says F, and I just wondered.
It might have been Francis, but I don't know.
Uh-huh.
You can have this stuff. As far as I know, you can get all kinds of animals. Now on here, now before we get into anything else, I want you just go down through. Here's one that you talked to Janetsky.
Oh yeah, well we're going to be talking to him later.
And that was in the paper after I think our meeting down here.
Yeah.
Yeah, you might have. If you want somebody, just look through this stuff, and if there's any letters in here, this is stuff that a lot of it's different meetings and stuff. And here is a brief history of Rio.
Right.
And
of
course, we had a tour guide.
Yeah.
And it was quite a sheaf paper, and I was one of the tour guides quite a few times down there. Of course, usually it was on days when I wasn't that busy, so to speak. But you can look through this and just see what all these things are. Some of these are some of the letters. And take what you want.
Okay.
And
we'll have to take some time to look through this.
Well, that's all right. I'll leave it with you. And then,
okay.
Now, those, while you're right at it, these are our field service representatives.
Mm-hmm.
Big part of them are dead by now.
Yeah. It's a great picture.
Yeah, you see.
They're on the back? Their names are on the back?
But I knew most of them because I dealt with them in my parts distribution.
He's on our list. Frank
Whiteman.
Oh, yes, he is.
Yeah, Frank Whiteman. He's with
list.
The labor union. He's down at the union hall.
Right.
But I knew most of these fellows, but on there right now, I'd have to kind of rack my memory.
Mr. Rankin, before we begin, I'm affiliated with the university, I need to have you sign some things.
Okay? I'd be happy to.
All right. This is really to protect you.
Well, it's all right. Both my kids graduated out.
Oh, really?
Oh,
okay. They make me do this. If I talk to anybody alive, I got to do this. This is just to let you know about the variety of options for doing oral history,
mm-hmm.
which is what we're going to be doing here.
Mm-hmm.
And that you can refuse to answer any questions, and that you can tell us to turn the table off.
2nd in 1947.
1947.
Mm-hmm. And I left there on March 31st in 1973. And you go down through the letters, there's my letter of resignation, and everything, you get the dates from that. Anyway.
Mm-hmm. From that information?
Yeah,
that
you can make
I put it all right here.
You can make copies if you want. If there's two copies there, you can take one.
Okay.
It'll be different.
Okay.
And
what did you start at? What was your first job?
Well, my first job was inventory control chief clerk.
Okay.
But of course, that was a step down from what I had just come from, but then it didn't matter too much. And I came back to Lansing. See, I had worked for, that's just pre-history of real. I came up to Lansing, this you can use if you want to, if you don't. I came up to Lansing to work for Nash Kelvinator in their propeller plants. Mm-hmm. And that was in 1941. Okay. And so I got all this scheduling. Those plants, the plant that is over there, over that, I'm all hoping at the corner building there.
Yeah, sure.
And that's where they built propellers.
Uh-huh.
And
for the war.
That plant where John, and they had that plant where John Bean mm-hmm. was. I had my first office in there.
Mm-hmm. And what was your job there?
Production scheduling. I've done all the scheduling for those plants. Mm-hmm. And I got some complicated work. And then when the war was over, thank gosh, then I was there for finishing up, and I had a bid to go to work for Ideal Power Lawnmower, which was a Lansing concern. And they were situated in the building where Capital City Lumber Company offices, big lumber building. That's where Ideal Lawnmower was. And I had worked there possibly 3 months, and Edwards Aircraft bought the company. Mm-hmm. And they also operated Indian Motorcycle Company in Springfield, Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. So they wanted to consolidate. It was my job then to get it all boxcarred up and shipped to Massachusetts. But I was production and material control manager for them. Mm-hmm. And at that time I was doing a great deal of purchasing for certain things in the factory. Well, that disrupted everything for a while, and I moved them down and got them all set up in production. And then it just happened that they wanted to consolidate the departments. I was just about a year there. And I told Mr. Dill, I'll go back to Lansing. I get a job there. Being subordinate to somebody else when I'm already in charge of something.
Yeah.
So I took my separation pay and came back to Lansing. Mm-hmm. Well, that was just about the end of 46 anyway. And I took a couple of weeks of looking around and finding a place to live again and all that. And I decided then that I started looking for a job. But I didn't look too far. I went into rehab. Mm-hmm. They were receptive and I had a couple of interviews. Mm-hmm. Now we're getting up to current time. I agreed to go to work.
Mm-hmm. And you said going back to Lansing, did you grow up here originally?
No, I was born and raised in Duluth, Minnesota.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah, back in 1910. So I'm not a spring chicken. You can see, possibly one of the older fellows you'll possibly be talking to as far as all that's concerned, for real. But my high school education, of course, was all direct for manual arts, and that's right at the head of the Big Depression. Of course, you were around by that time, I'm sure, but you weren't there.
No. my parents were, though.
I was already accepted at Stout Institute in Wisconsin to go to manual arts school, mm-hmm. but boy, I tell you, things were rough. Couldn't make it. So all I've ever had is a formal high school education, mm-hmm. and a lot of hard work other than that.
Right.
But things weren't too robust in the world. I did work for Pittsburgh Coal Company on the dock office for a while, but that just dropped right out of sight. So then I stayed around, worked farm labor and stuff like that, and then finally decided to get out of the roof because of this. Based on lumber industry and the ore mining up on the range, there just wasn't anything going on. Even the ore mines were down.
Hmm.
So I decided to go to Detroit.
Oh, so you went from
there
to Detroit.
Detroit in 1935.
Hmm.
And I'd done about everything you could imagine there, odd jobs. I never got on welfare, by the way.
Hmm. Did you pick Detroit?
I kept on working.
Did you pick Detroit in the industry?
Well, because of the auto industry business, and figured, well, it'd be a lot of work. But oddly enough, I didn't really get in the auto industry until after I sailed the Great Lakes for a couple of years. Oh. And I sailed the Great Lakes out of Rouge, Michigan.
Mm-hmm.
And I sailed the Nicholson Terminal Dock in British Columbia, decking and cooking.
Oh, that looks very beautiful.
Yeah, I done boiling around in general and stuff like that. And then I finally got a job with Atlas Foundry Company. That's South Liberty, south of Port Street. You know Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
It's changed a lot since then. I worked in there as a core maker and assistance to the form setters on the floor for castings.
Mm.
And I will say, by the way, I did recognize some of the names that came in for experimental engines out of Lansing, Michigan, and I think some of them were definitely older.
Oh.
That's back in 1936.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember that, 36, 37. But, you know, you just keep them working and try to keep away from getting a dole, and we never did get a dole.
Yeah.
I kept working. I always did say that.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to work, you can find a job. I mean, some kind of job. You don't want to be too proud.
Yeah.
If you're too proud, you may never work. I don't know. It's getting rough right now. When you're on retired pensions, which aren't too good, and if you didn't save for a rainy day, it could be a lot tougher. I look at it, and this is just the record. I think of anybody in the retired and it's right today, and he's trying to live off of interest on the savings and CDs.
Yeah, that's what my parents
are doing. The percentages have gone down
that's
so
right.
low, I tell you, you're going to have to start changing your way, unless you've got a lot of money.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot in reserve where you can suffer those things.
Mm-hmm.
Well, my wife is a good manager, I won't say that.
Yeah.
And we've been married for 57 years.
Wow.
With a good manager and both seeing eye to eye on issues, you can manage.
Mm-hmm.
You set your right.
Yeah. Your pension from Rio wasn't what it would have been.
My pension from Rio, unless I took out a small pension out of my own personal pension, see, at that time. But right now, it's taken both of those just to pay my new husband's shield.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
We've heard this from other, with the health care. Yeah.
And it's unfortunate that it has to be this way.
Yeah.
Except that I'm Blue Cross, I think, is just a little too high. And I'm not thinking of switching over to AARP.
Oh.
Because I've heard others say that it's a good plan.
Yeah.
And you got to look at it and say, well, we got to eat, so we better save all the dollars we can someplace. I don't have nothing wrong with Blue Cross. It's coverage, don't get me wrong. But it's just a premium. It'll cost you $300 a month.
I know.
That's terrible.
Yeah.
I think that's when somebody's bleeding somebody.
It certainly bears looking into if anybody would.
Now getting back to Rio.
Well, what I want to know is how you got from Detroit to Lansing.
Oh,
yes,
well.
I was going to ask
all right. Now, there's a kind of a good story. And I always did say it isn't what you know, it's who you know.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it leads up to a story which I think it's quite interesting. Now, when I went to work for Nash Kelvinator, I had been at the foundry, and I made acquaintance with a few people. We lived on Hubbard Avenue in an apartment, and in that apartment there was a man by the name of Summers, and I made another acquaintance of Mr. Boland, and both of these happened to be personnel directors in some capacities.
Huh?
And I I went to work for Nash Calvary here, and they liked my work, but they went on strike, and then I was out. Mm. And of course, then between there, I went over to DeSoto Motors, and I worked for DeSoto, and I was up and stuck to the line. Mm-hmm. And of course, on Calvary here, I was strictly working on the line, putting nuts and bolts and together in calvinators and refrigerators. And
they went out on strike and you lost your job because of the strike?
Well, just like you say, temporary layoff until they get the strike settled, so to speak.
Right, so
but
you don't want to stick around.
I couldn't wait for that, so yeah. I went to work for DeSoto Motors for a while. Mm-hmm.
Was that your answer?
That, no, that was on Mark Twain Avenue in Detroit. It's off Plymouth Road.
Oh, I see.
Towards Lansing, and I put, and they went on the strike.
Oh. This was 37, when everybody was going out?
Yeah, 37, around there. And, but I shuffled between the two, and then I went to work, I got a job with J.F. Waters Motor Sales. Now, they built Skyview taxi cabs. Most of them were headed for New York. Oh. And there was a man in there, Mr. Fox, and he was general manager, and I was working the receiving room, and we were getting to quite a story, and so now between the two things, and then you come up to Lend-Lease,
mm-hmm.
and I studied 38 when
right.
we were on Lend-Lease, and then J.F. Waters had a directive that they couldn't get equipment to continue building Skyview cabs. And they were building Skyview cabs on DeSoto chassis.
Mm.
So between there and my good friends that were working as personnel directors in a couple of companies, I found a job over at Wayne, Michigan with the Bendix Aircraft. And I was in charge of tools and buying tools for the production of four. And I worked there for possibly, maybe close to a year. And I was getting up in the 40s and making keeping my nose to the grindstone was a thing, keeping my face clean and all that. And talking with, and we played bridge with these other people too. One of the personnel directors and his wife. And we played bridge. So you got to keep your ends tied in. And when Calvinator got the directive to build propellers in Lansing, and I knew Mr. Bolden, and he was with Bendix Aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was my lead to get into Bendix Aircraft.
Mm-hmm.
So like I say, it isn't what you was, who you know. And they knew I had experience in a certain amount of scheduling and parts. And so they got together, and I had a call to Mr. Poland's office when I was working there one day at Phoenix. And he says, how would you like to go up to Lansing? I says, well, it depends. I said, I'm not unhappy in the tool room down there. I hope I'm doing a good enough job that you just don't want to get rid of me. And, to get the word. And he says, well, I know Mr. Summers quite well. And he says he's not up there yet because they haven't opened.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're receptive, we'll start working on it. And so they worked on it for quite a while. I hadn't heard a thing. And they decided that I would fit in pretty good. So it came around pretty close to the 41 date coming up.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, how would you call me in the end? He said, well, and it all arranged. If it's all right with you, it's defense industry, so your 4A rating won't be affected. You're in defense industry right now.
Mm-hmm.
And Mr. Summers, I should fit in. So I left there on a Friday night. Next morning, I'm working for Nash Calvinator in Lansing.
Wow.
You see, that brings us up to the war.
Right.
I've done all the production schedule next couple of years, both plants. I had the first office I had was upstairs in the old John Bean. See, there was an office for it. There were where those. There's a engraving place up on the floor there. Mm-hmm. Remember where the ramp used to go across?
Yes, I do.
Yeah, we've talked about that before.
You come right in, right into that section.
On the spot engraving.
Yeah, that's right. He used to be a real man.
Oh,
too. Oh, yeah. He used to work with him.
Hmm.
In case you didn't know that.
No, I didn't.
Yeah, on the spot. That was Reed, I think is his name, Mr. Reed. And his wife worked there.
Mm-hmm.
But I had an office in there, and my immediate supervisor was Mr. Baldwin, which I think right today, I don't know if he's living or not, but he was with Food Machine and Chemical Corporation at one time.
Mm-hmm.
And he was chief at that time. But then he left and then moved my office over to Mount Hope, where that big building was, right over the main entrance at that time.
Mm-hmm.
And so I worked there all through the war.
Mm-hmm. What did this company make during the war?
Propellers.
Propellers.
Yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my preliminary history before you get really into shifting around again with like with Ideal Lawnmower, and then going down to Springfield, Massachusetts, which was moving the family there.
Yeah.
And,
so you just assumed staying in the Lansing area.
And then coming back to Lansing.
Right.
Because I liked Lansing when I was here. I thought, well, I won't go back to Detroit again, so I went to Lansing. I knew Detroit pretty well by that time.
Yeah. But were you happy about working at Rio? I mean, had you heard about the company
the
before?
The thing, and I'll say this with unqualifications, it's just, you know, you get into a company that is what you call, and I think it's family oriented. You realize that after you got in there. Everybody seemed to be so friendly with one another.
Mm-hmm.
And in other words, you work with them and you became one of them right now.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't seem to have a prejudice in their mind.
Yeah.
And I think, because, you know, Rio, from my previous history on it, was quite an apprentice associated company.
Oh.
They train people, and I think if you go back and talk to people my age and older, if they're still living, may have had some bit of work at some time in their life with Rio.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, they produced people that went out and done good jobs for other people.
Oh, I see. Yeah. Moved up in the company.
And moved up, and they were, I think, very much of the mind to promote from within.
Mm-hmm.
And that's good for a company. You can work there, and if they all of a sudden go out and hire somebody that can do the job from outside, I think you cause a little hard feelings.
Mm-hmm.
What am I working for here? So I had quite a history of advancement, so I'm not really talking about just not knowing.
Right.
And I didn't get hit any place.
And so you started out as inventory
control
chief clerk.
Right. Okay. And that's right directly under the parts manager.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And then you worked your way up.
And I worked my way up. As things opened up, I was asked if I cared to try it.
Mm-hmm.
So I was on that job for possibly, I'd say, it was better than 6 months, 6-7 months, and keeping the inventory control up. And I don't know if anybody mentioned Mr. Post, Al Post.
No.
Al Post had the pricing operation, all parts pricing. And he decided to leave to go with General Electric. And they asked me if I'd like to take over the pricing operation. I said, well, I'll try anything once, because that guy, he says, well, you've had a pretty good record in the past where you've been, so they had looked it up. And I said, yeah, I'll give it a swing. So I was moved over to the pricing manager. Now, that entailed setting all the service parts pricing, of course, based on manufacturing costs and getting the price list from the various suppliers like Dana's, Clark Equipment, and whoever we bought equipment from for our parts price catalog. And you had to get all those lists, and then you published them based on your cost from them, but you usually followed, if they had a retail price list to the outside in their outlets, you usually followed their retail price, but you made prices based on your cost to get the product to your dealerships and your distributorships, mm-hmm, and to your branches. It was very various prices. Usually there was about three different prices, a list, a dealer, and a distributor, and if it was a branch, they got an override. Mm-hmm. But I didn't know too much what the override was, so whatever it was when it was billed after they bought cards, the accounting department usually gave whatever their override was, their discount off the dealer, mm-hmm, price. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't know that because I wasn't in the accounting section. But I worked at that job for 10 years. Now, I had a very efficient young lady, mm-hmm, Bertha Heiner was her name when we started. And she had worked for Alpos, so she knew pretty well the procedure. So,
and I, now, was she an assistant or a secretary?
Well,
or?
She was secretary and typist and everything else. Uh-huh. And only the two of us running the job. So, and I will say this much, you could never get a secretary so versed in doing things and not afraid of a job. Mm-hmm. She was it. A number one. Mm. And she lives over on Climax Street here in Manchester.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, just off of Pennsylvania.
Right.
Her name is now Bertha Munez.
Munez.
Okay. Her name is Munez, M-U-N-R-Z.
Oh, I
have
so. And her maiden name was Heiner, H-E-I-N-E-R?
That was Heiner. She was born, I think, in Fowler, Michigan. Uh-huh. But, yeah, I don't know whether it was between there and some other, mm-hmm, like followers up on Highway 21,
mm-hmm, sure,
west of St. John's. Mm-hmm. So, but then, of course, she married Pete Munez. Of course, that's quite a while ago. But otherwise, I know them very well. I still send Christmas cards. Mm-hmm. But we worked together for about 10 years, and we kind of changed the pricing department over from, we farmed out most of the price list compilation with Franklin Decline. Mm-hmm. Now Franklin Decline was right, it's that building right next to the main fire station, just to the south.
Yes.
That used to be Franklin Decline's. And they done most of the binder work and everything else for a long time. We submitted the typewritten copy of our prices in our listings, mm-hmm, the way we wanted them, and they made the book.
I see.
But while I was on it, we changed over and we did all the complete assembly of the book and everything at our own place.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a good, mm-hmm, we had a good printing department, and so we used it. Tom Shoulders was the manager of the printing department at that time, and that was in the basement of the clubhouse.
Oh. And I kind of printed up the Spirit and all the journals and everything.
That's where everything got printed.
Right.
And,
yeah, I know.
And I think Bob Myers was the cafeteria over in that basement too, mm-hmm, which was quite an evening. Great guy too.
Mm-hmm. I knew there was a cafeteria down there. Right. I didn't know there was a print shop though.
Right. You should get most of this information also from a lot of the other folks.
Yeah.
So we changed it all over and got that. So we done all our own printing and we done all our own artwork.
In mm-hmm. fact,
several of the catalogs had some of the mock-ups that I had used mm-hmm. on my own. I always like to experiment with things when I'm doing them. You know, there were many a night I'd come back after dinner and do some extra work just to try to get the job running a little bit better.
Mm-hmm.
And like I always, my philosophy has always been, if you've got a benefactor and he sees to it that you get some, don't ever let him down. Just work a little harder, at least put that extra benefit, so at least you support his confidence in you. That's been my philosophy for all through.
Wonderful philosophy.
Never, never, never let your benefactor down. And make him look good in his judgment.
Yeah. At least with Rio, from what we've been hearing from other people, you could pretty much count on getting good response to that kind of philosophy.
Well, I think it's the way, I think everybody's forgotten that they're, you know, like I said before, yeah. It isn't what you know, it's who you know.
Yeah.
But if you will work and develop upon it, You can make yourself that. And I like to think that I had created that much confidence in anybody that saw what I could do and what I was willing to try, that I would at least make it go. And you might have read in the paper just the other day where Pete Hamlin died in Holland, Michigan.
Yeah.
He was general service manager when I was. He just died over in Holland. I think he was in his late 90s. And he was a swell guy.
Was it Hamling?
Hamling.
Oh, Hamling.
H-A-M-E-L-I-N-K. He's a very fine gentleman.
And you mentioned Tom Shoulders, right?
Tom Shoulders. It's not Shoulders.
Oh.
Leave the D out. Shoulders. Yeah, he was in charge of the printing department. In Rio at that time. And I think at that time, I don't know if the manager of the club rose. So, Charles, well, anyway, he worked for the state capitol in records or things or something like that, or custodian or something, after he left Rio. And he was a ball player too, with the Rio Balls. Well, somebody else will tell you, if not, if you talk to, I know that Red O'Brien will know the name. It'll come to me.
Okay.
I'll think a little bit. Maybe I'm getting Alzheimer's.
Oh, no, I don't think so.
The ball team, that sounds interesting.
Well, Rio had a pretty good ball team at one time, but that was possibly more before I got there.
I see.
Yeah, they practically were into everything at one time.
Yeah.
In fact, they had bowling alley down in the basement in the early days, but they weren't there when I got there.
They weren't there by then?
No, they were already. That's where the
printing department.
Took over.
Did they have other sports teams still by the committee?
The bowling team was pretty well known all through the league and all that. In fact, I still go with, we played bridge with Glenn Sine, whose dad was one of the early bowlers with the Rio at one time. But Glenn Sine was the... we put a bridge with him at times now, but he was with Shepherd's Shoes for years. But his dad worked for him before I ever got there.
What about the band, the Rio Band? Was that disbanded?
The Rio Band, I don't know. It's more than likely just as things got more modern and along, I suppose it just faded out.
It wasn't
there when I was there, but they still had the nice... pipe organ in the clubhouse.
Sure.
And it was really a good organ. I hope it's still working for somebody someplace. Somebody bought it or went to a museum, so I don't know where it is.
Is that the big organ that had been in the Ariel's home at one time?
I don't know where it come from, but I knew several people that played it. I never played the organ, so. I do have a little small organ at home, but it's it's one of these Yamahas. But I'm just monkeying around with it. I haven't really learned to play it yet. But anyway, getting back to the pricing department and the progression as we go, it was about 10 years, and then Tom Bates, now that's the name.
I know that name, yeah.
He had the export department, export parts and service. And from that, he went home, had a heart attack.
Yeah, he, I was going to say, he was around before the war.
Yeah, right.
I know his name from
stuff I read. And a very, very fine gentleman.
Right.
Very friendly and all that. Now, I'd never had any experience in export in the past. And he died, and Pete Hamlet called me into the office in the morning and said, well, we've lost a good man over there. He says, that's what he heard. I said, yeah, I heard. He says, I don't envy you changing jobs because you're doing a good job of what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
But then he said, Frankie, he says, no matter what you think, I think you can handle the job that Tom Bates is doing. You know, if you look at it and say, well, from pricing going into export and parts and service for export, and you got to know a lot of export regulations. I said, he said, well, as of right now, if you want it, if you will take it, you're an export parts and service man.
Wow.
He said, I'll give you a couple of days to, because that you can lay over there, the secretary that's over there can more or less handle the immediate stuff. But I want you to go over there and get all those export books out and start looking at them and see what it looks like. And in a couple of days, if you decide it's too much for you, he said, just tell me and we'll get somebody else out there.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I looked him over and I said, well, it doesn't look that bad with a good secretary like I had when I left the pricing department. You can get an awful lot of guidance.
Yeah.
And so between the two, I went over and I talked to a young lady and she said, well, I know pretty well what the documents are needed, and we'll, just so we get the right stuff and all that. He says, you know the parts and the interpretation, so mm-hmm. I had to do all my own interpretation on the orders that come in mm-hmm. from export. If they come in like worded in Spanish, we set out the letters and had them transcribed into English.
Mm-hmm.
I changed that, by the way. But after a while, then we've done that for a while until we got going. And then you've talked to Luis Garcia,
mm-hmm.
and he may not have told you.
He did the Spanish for you.
I used to think, I used to sit down, if there's something I needed to know right now, I'd go down to the press room and I'd see Louis. I'd say, Louis, what does this say?
Mm-hmm. So he was valuable in ways that he didn't tell us.
Did he ever tease you and give you the wrong explanation?
No. He's
such a jokester.
He would tell me a lot of times that in the Spanish there are sometimes multiple versions.
Right.
In other words, it all depends on which context you were talking in.
Mm-hmm.
So he would explain it to me that you might mention this particular phrase and it would imply in general conversation, but in the parts and service in here, and this is what he more than likely means.
Mm-hmm.
So he would tell me, and I'd come back up and I'd be able to get the order. Now, for a while, I would send some of those out anyway and get them interpreted, just from the interpreter. We used to send them down to Detroit, and of course, by the time you got it back, it was 3 or 4 days.
Yeah.
And sometimes the essence was that you had to get something out pretty quick by air.
Oh.
And so you do it. My eyes water like the dickens. Mm. It isn't because I'm crying or anything. My tear ducts, possibly the drainage ones, are loaded up and they just
spill over.
Get on the bottom of my glass that I can't see. But anyway, things went on like that, and we worked at it for a long time. pretty good. It came up to the time. See, we were, the company at the time was floating between buyers.
Mm. Well, it was.
See, it was Bone Aluminum Brass at us.
Right.
And then it went on up for a while, and then White Motors.
White Motors.
Now, that's when White Motors, I was in part and export parts and service,
mm-hmm.
and I was running the job all right. And then White Motors bought us. Mm-hmm. Whatever the date was, I can't tell you exactly. But when they bought us, they wanted to consolidate the export.
Mm.
So getting things all together and everything and getting our export dovetailed in with the export in Cleveland, I had to go down to Cleveland. The first time I went down, I took most of my records with me, and I was down there for 2 weeks, and working with Joe Strauss, who was the export parts and service man down there, and went down there and I worked with them, and they were very nice, everything was nice. I had an office, and I was mostly in Joe Strauss's office anyway, but I had an office to work in. And,
mm-hmm.
and correlate things, but we got along fine, and then I came back to Lansing, and I had to go down, I didn't go back down for a week, but then I went down every morning for a couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm.
I'd go out to the airport, and I'd get down to Hopkins Airport, I was on Eastern Airlines, and I'd go on down there, and by the time I get to the office, it'd be lunch hour. And we'd sit and talk about things that they had, in the stuff that I had brought down before that they didn't quite understand.
Mm-hmm.
We'd go in and we'd talk maybe a couple hours and dovetail them and get them lined up where either I thought or Joe Strauss thought, because in their system, a little bit different. And then I'd have to head back for Hopkins Airport to get a plane to get back into Lansing. Well, that would have to be a good bad routine.
Yeah.
I was kind of glad when it stopped. But as you know, it didn't last too long with White
mm-hmm.
after that.
Mm-hmm.
And we got it worked in. And it happened to be that I was down to Cleveland that one day, and I got a call from Mr. Collins. He was general sales manager for Rio in Lansing. And he said, I want you to come back as fast as you can get here. I want to talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, again, I knew there must be something up, and I didn't know what. But naturally, being flexible, I had to catch that same plane I normally caught, and I went right to the office rather. But he wasn't in. He had left for the afternoon, so the next morning, I had a note on my desk where I had been. He says, to see you as soon as you get in.
Mm-hmm.
So now it's like Mr. Collins. He says, I don't want you to feel that you're at loose ends now that you don't have a job. I said, well, what do you got in mind? He says, we need a warranty manager. So I took over the warranty for a couple
mm-hmm.
years.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in between a lot of things, and in the meantime, between that and being part of White, so I took over the warranty, and it was a Tony Rose that was in there, and Harold Link, one of the servicemen on that big picture.
Uh-huh.
There, I'll show you if you want to get that picture. Just a minute, I'll show you which one is Harold Link. He's dead now. He lived in Astoria, Ohio. That's Harold Link.
Okay.
And this is Bob Johnson in here, and this is Harry Finn. I know those three. He took over as general service manager after Pete Hamling. At one time.
I'm sorry, what was
that's Bob Johnson. He's dead also. And Harry Finn is dead, I know
that's
that.
That's Harry Finn,
F-I-N-N? Yeah, F-I-N-N. Hmm. And he was a good help in a lot of things around the office because he'd been there for a long time.
Now, the exporting, they just decided to keep up the Cleveland end and to phase out the Lansing end.
Right, that's it?
Okay.
So, all right, I might think of a couple of these others. But anyway, between them and, I'm talking about warranties.
Right, so you went on.
When you're talking about these are field servicemen. Mm-hmm. They go out on problems. Mm-hmm. If you got a problem in a dealership or a distributorship, and you're thinking that they're trying to keep you off or something like that, they know the problem. Because I'd get a warranty claim in, and not knowing all of the features of the truck and all of the things that could happen, I would, Harry Finn had a desk almost right across from me in a little office, and I'd say if he was in, I'd ask him. Or Tony Rose, who had been with the company a long time, and he was working in the office, and he worked also with me on a warranty. And between them, and we decided whether we could give them what they were asking for, or talk to them on the phone. No, not always forget it. You possibly owe them something, but maybe not the whole truck, so to speak. So you worked it out. And I worked at that for quite a while, and then when Capert bought the company, how we get up to that point.
Mm-hmm.
Now, at that time, when Capert bought it, they were at loose ends for a pricing man again.
Oh.
So, and all that. Now look, I got along good with Capert's. I realize there's some people didn't, and of course maybe they take the wrong attitude. I don't know. I don't believe that everybody's bad all the way through.
Mm-hmm.
And some people couldn't get along with Mrs. Johnson.
No, we heard about her. Mildred Johnson.
Miller.
Yeah.
So they knew my qualifications from previous anyway. If they bought the company, they must have looked at the record of people. And they wanted to get somebody to handle the pricing. So I talked to Mildred, and she was quite receptive. She says, well, you've done it before, you should know. So I took over the pricing again. And of course, I had moved my office. Oh, there's one just in between that. Do you have to do anything on
that? Nope,
no,
okay.
No.
All right. In between that.
Between the warranty and the pricing?
Yeah. They needed an assistant export salesman.
Oh, so you went back to export again?
Yeah, so I went back to export.
Okay.
But in the sales capacity.
I see.
I worked under Mr. Chuck Dunford.
Mm-hmm. What's his name?
Charles Dunford. He lives out on Sunset in East Lansing.
Oh, I know.
We get together quite often. Dunford. C.S. Dunford Jr. His dad was a professor at the college in finance, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It's called, but you can get that from somebody else too. And he's a very fine gentleman. He passed away too. But, and Chuck and I get along fine together. A lot of people didn't like, but they thought Chuck was a little too aloof in a lot of cases.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Chuck did keep himself apart from a lot. Because, you know, you're in a sort of a business. Export is peculiar to a business.
Yeah.
Anything that comes in from a foreign country has got to be handled maybe in a little different manner. And I think a lot of people come in export and they're found, you treat them a little bit different. They have a little different idea of etiquette.
Mm-hmm.
You treat them different, and you got to respect them more. It's their way, so you try to conform
mm-hmm.
to an extent. Well, as assistant export sales manager, which was a different field entirely, had always been parts and service, I also then, when White was kind of out of it, I got back in contact with a lot of people I had been in contact through the Export Parts and Service, because you were corresponding also on parts versus buying trucks.
Mm.
So then I got reacquainted with some of the people that I had got away from for quite a while,
mm-hmm.
and they were kind of happy to hear from me again, but in a new capacity, especially a few of them in South America.
Mm-hmm.
And as an export, assistant export sales manager, I did make a trip over to Iraq and Iran and Lebanon.
That's interesting.
When
was that?
That was in 1966, I think. Heinisch was the general manager of the company at the time,
mm-hmm.
and he thought that I would fit in to go over to Iraq, Lebanon, because there was a joint venture that came up between American Motors, that's Jeeps and so forth,
right.
And they sent Walt Jensen and myself from Rio with a representative from American Motors, and we went over to Iraq. Well, I went dual purpose. I went over to see our dealers in Lebanon, because they were very good dealers. So along with that, then we went over to Baghdad and set in with the, they were a dictatorship at that time, military rule. But nothing ever worked out. There was a question of content. They had to make so much of the equipment to put in, they had to do all the assembly, and whatever the report was from Walt Jensen and our general area service manager that was over there also entered into it. I mean, my report on parts setups and all that is to our service manager for it, but I don't know, maybe there'd be a letter like that in the folders. I don't know. It may not be in there, and it may be in the general file, but it's all in the files in Rio. But I wrote a quite a lengthy report on it, and had a good trip, by the way. I got an ear infection.
Oh.
Otherwise, I'd have gone out to Pakistan and a few other dealers before I came back. The doctor over there says, you better get back. What they call an Asiatic ear.
Oh my.
It hasn't affected it too much, but I came back, went to the company doctor, and he took care of it. I had quite a few punctured eardrums and the medicine was behind it.
Oh,
and finally got it cleared up, but otherwise everything was all right.
How were you all received and treated while you were around?
Oh, we had a very good dealer in Lebanon. Mr. Barbari, he was I was invited to his house for dinner.
Hmm.
And he had servants come out of his ears, but
yeah.
And he told me to go down and see his doctor. So he went down. He says, "Well," he says, "you got it. It's quite early in it." He says, "But I advise you not to stay around here any longer than your business demands. And get back to your doctor and mm-hmm. get it taken care of, because you could lose a hearing in a year."
Oh,
so I took his advice, and instead of going on to Lebanon, and maybe I might even hit Japan before I came back, but that kind of abbreviated the trip. But of course, again, looks I might have saved the company money too.
This was the reason for this trip was to start. Are reels being sold in Iraq.
See, that was to possibly set up. They wanted to get possibly Rio trucks or Diamond T trucks too at the time, but they wanted their country demanded so much labor and so much material in the truck from their own source. See, and those are the things that hurt, you know. You could build, we would have to, like say, build the truck up here and then tear it down and ship it over there piecemeal, except for the parts that they're going to make and put on.
Oh, So it wouldn't even be a totally real truck, would it?
No, but it would be a real, they couldn't make the engines and they couldn't make the powertrain, but they could possibly make sheet metal and stuff to put on it. I don't know what kind of glass they put in it, but what glass was one of the things they were going to get from European areas.
Oh, they were going
to, yeah, try to get, yeah.
I wonder why they didn't want to just import the truck as it was made
here. The laws over there dictate that anything imported has to be assembled in their country and have certain much of their country's content.
To protect their
Nations, sure. So that's a thing you have in export in a lot of cases. Countries want to put a lot of their stuff in it to protect their own industries. That goes with a lot. We didn't have that problem with Australia. We shipped an awful lot of trucks to Australia and South Africa.
Really, just
As is. Yeah, we either send them in built up, or very few times you build up, but you tear, you build them up and make sure you run and test them, and then tear them down and box them.
And they would reassemble.
And they'd reassemble.
How many countries, I wonder, were we shipping trucks to during the '60s?
The biggest share of the truck, the biggest, I would say, 90% of the trucks that time when I was an assistant export sales manager went to Australia and South Africa. Now South America was pretty well closed off, although there was still a lot of trucks down there. Probably sent occasional truck down, but not too many of them. And Puerto Rico, we sent a lot of trucks to. In fact, I went to Puerto Rico on one trip too. I was a volunteer.
Why would South America close off?
Well, they have laws that dictate their own content and all that, and it's a little harder to sell when you have those problems. And of course, that a lot of times was, it became part of my job to determine those things too, but Chuck Dunford was the general sales, export sales manager, so he usually knew pretty well and kept up with those particular laws, which every once in a while we'd get abridged and try to
change things. The regimes were changing very fast in South America at that time.
Yes, so. That's true.
We had a few deals going with Pakistan. We never did ship too much there, but parts we did, but not trucks. And I think we had one at Phnom Penh in Laos, I think. Parts, but not trucks. We tried to get trucks in there, but couldn't do it.
How about Japan in those days? You mentioned
Japan. We had a dealership there, but we never done too much with them. They came in. They were very nice people to talk to when they had to come into the factory.
We ship some, but not a lot.
We shipped parts to the trucks that had already possibly got there through some roundabout way, I don't know.
Yeah, they were trying to learn as much as they could about us.
Oh, yeah. I'm sure of that. I think we'd like to know a lot about them, too.
So then you went from that assistant, then back to pricing.
Then I went back to pricing after that. And I also, you may have heard somebody mention Harry Elsenheimer.
No, not that name.
No, Harry Elsenheimer was my golf partner most of the time. But he had government and parts sales, government and government parts sales. And I also inherited that after that, along with the pricing again. And so I worked at that until I retired from pricing. And I trained, I can't remember the name of one fellow to handle the export, because export could have been a pain in the neck along with the government parts was nothing of any great note. We didn't do too much. I quote to different government agencies, like mostly the Navy and the ground forces and the Air Force. And my biggest problem with them was trying to convince them that they didn't have to buy any more parts.
Oh, really?
Well, now, it's contrary to a lot of things. But I don't like to say it, but I think a lot of times they're a little bit bullheaded. I think they get fed up in their importance. They wanted it out right tonight by air. And I would say, well, and I go to the record and I say, we shipped so many, like, to, if it was coming out of L.A., I'd say, we shipped so many of that part to Port Hueneme Depot. And I'd give them the date and the number of the order.
Mm-hmm.
Can't bother to go to the depot to get it. Got to have it on the air tonight.
Oh.
And, you know, it kind of burns you when you sold them I could say, and I don't care whether the record says it or not, you can delete it if you want to, but I think it's what we're talking about, toilet seats for $50.
Yeah,
and
yes,
so.
Yeah.
And today, and when you have sent them a couple of very, very critical screws or bolts for a certain area in the engine, and you, by the time you had packaged that for non-rust and make sure that it was going to be ready for the day they needed it,
mm-hmm.
they could have got over there and got it for a lot less, and they might have charged them $5 for one bolt. By the time you
put the special handling and everything,
it's the special handling that you try to avoid. By the time, and then by the time you went and got one out of the stockroom, put it in a box and put it on an aircraft, they'd pay five times what you even done for packaging, but you sent it to them, several of them. But they didn't want to pay. And Harry told me the same thing. Harry Elsman ever before I took it over when he retired.
Mm.
He says, they'll want it right on the plane. They don't want to take time to go and look for it at the depot.
And
it's the inefficiency I would say in government in general.
Yeah.
Governments should not be in business under any condition.
Well, I just thought.
Government should only be in the business of governing.
Like
who
that.
Was it said back in the 80s? I can't remember who the quote was, to the extent is that government is too busy doing everything to do the job that they're elected to do is govern.
Mm-hmm. Well, Thomas Jefferson said, government that governs least governs best.
That goes back a little bit farther.
From the very beginning.
There was another senator or somebody said it later on in the 80s. And I think back in the 80s, somebody said in there, everything would close the patent office because everything that's could have been discovered has been discovered. Untrue that ever.
I hope that's not true. We need a lot more discoveries.
And like Al Jolson said in this one of his programs, just a moment before you can see, hear nothing. You haven't written nothing yet.
Right.
I can't imagine what there is to discover. I don't have the mind to analyze the technical aspects of electronics.
I have a little baby girl at home, and what she's going to be, 20, 30 years down the line, what's going to be common for her is just going to be amazing.
When you grow up with it and live with it, it becomes just second nature. It's born in you, possibly.
Well, I remember when I stayed up as a teenager to watch The Moonshot, in 1959, and my grandfather was staying with us. And I was thinking when he was born, there wasn't even electric light.
That's right.
I think
it's
just in my life.
It's just
amazing.
Of course, you see, this, now we get back and on the record or off the record, we get jumpers that I see the wife every once in a while. I'll go out to see if a satellite's going over. When they say it's going to go over, I go out, if it's clear, I go out just to see it. Says, well, you seen it before? I says, yeah, but I marvel at how they can keep that thing up there.
The kids just take it for granted.
And I say, I read, when I was a kid, I liked scientific articles. Buck Rogers was fascinating to me. And if I think back, and if you think back, how many of those things as a kid you'd say, oh, they're just imagining, they're never going to happen.
That's right.
Everything I've imagined is happening.
Well, I'm pretty young comparatively.
Yeah.
When I was in college, nobody had computers.
Well, that's right.
Every one of my students now is
university. Yeah, their papers on computers.
If I might just make a comment on computers, I would ban them from high schools. Until they learn the basics.
Right.
When you learn the basics that you can do it on pencil and paper, forget the computer.
Yeah.
That's time enough. You may learn it, but don't use it here. It's on
until you learn
paper.
It. Yeah. No, I know. Or calculator.
Then you got the basic background.
Yeah.
Yes, you got it.
Now, don't get me wrong. I left the company in 73. Computers were just nicely getting started. Sure, we had computers between the stock room and my desk.
Mm-hmm.
I could tell whether I had a part in stock or not.
Right. That helps a lot.
Sure, I didn't even have to get on the telephone as much as that.
Right.
And if they kept the inventory control properly in the stock room when they let it go, it would say on the computer how many there was in the bin.
Yeah.
That I usually relied on when I told somebody on the telephone.
Mm-hmm.
Look, I got it in. You want it? I can order, put it on the order desk right now.
Mm-hmm.
When you left in 72, could you see the incoming for the 20, for the bank? I say, when you left in 73, could you see that it was going to be going into bankruptcy and coming to an end?
No, not necessarily. I thought there was on a kind of an unsteady footing. I didn't leave for that reason. And I possibly could have stayed, but my letter of resignation will tell you primarily why I left, and I'll tell you verbally. You know, when you get up there and you're, of course, I was only 62, and just about 63. I was going to be 63 in April, and I left at the end of March in 73.
Mm-hmm.
So I was going to be 63, and all the time between the time I worked for Rio, and we traveled every summer. We went someplace. We like to get out of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And when you get restricted down to 2 weeks to go someplace, and it may be to the West Coast or maybe a lot of other places, I decided, well, I'll get out now while I'm still able, still physically able to do a lot of things, and we'll travel without any having to hurry back.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the last few years at Rio, my boss almost told me, he said, if we could get rid of you for 5 weeks without needing you, we wouldn't need you.
I almost
told you that you better abbreviate your vacations and take your vacations and split. I was allowed 5 weeks of vacation, but I could only take 2 weeks at a time to get back there to run the store, so to speak.
Yeah.
So part of it was to not have to break it up. In fact, the last year I was there, it was so busy and hectic that I didn't even get any vacation. In fact, I asked for that as paid time on my retirement.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see the letter. It says, I expect to get paid for the vacation, which I had to forego.
Right.
And they agreed to it, so. But like, I've heard them say this now. I've heard them say that in several places, that vacations are fine and lengthy ones are great, but if a company can get rid of you for that length of time, you're not on the job, why do they need you in the first place?
Yeah.
You can see the philosophy.
I can see the logic in it. Yeah.
But I always felt that my department was well run by my secretary when I wasn't there, because she knew what she was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And I had fortunate to have very good secretaries. Those with moxie. Mm-hmm.
Well, sometimes of the year it's not as busy as other times of the year.
Well, that's true, but in the parts business, there isn't any slow time.
Mm-hmm.
A truck breaks down.
Could be
any day, any time. I wouldn't say I was a cure to a lot of ills, but I tried to avoid the ills if I could, see what I mean?
Yeah.
You gotta anticipate, and I anticipated that. I'm living on government time now, but maybe unfortunately a lot of people have died before. In fact, just a comment on on my vision of certain things during the time I was there.
Yeah.
Rio had a retirement that you could retire at 65, mm-hmm. but you had to retire at 67.
Oh, mandatory.
Mandatory.
Yeah.
I still say mandatory retirements are a good thing that should be in the industry.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not talking about discrimination, age discrimination. I think, I'm almost sure that as you grow older, your efficiency drops
mm-hmm.
to an extent. I mean your physical ability to perform. And if a company thinks that 67, like they did, felt that that was a time that to leave the job for somebody else
mm-hmm.
and get out. I've seen people forced to retire at 67 down there, like the people knew them personally. They were dead within a year.
Oh.
Their routine had been disrupted.
Yeah, yeah.
They had more a path to that truck door
yeah.
over the years. And without that, and they hadn't provided for retirement. They hadn't thought of retirement as being loose of those responsibilities.
Yeah.
Their life was based on whatever, doing this every day. And if you left them on the same job all the time, they'd been doing it until they dropped dead at the desk.
Mm.
Your mind ruled the fact that they were at a loss, loose ends.
Mm.
Mine never was that way. I was ready for retirement.
You could retire
I had too many things to do, and I felt that whoever was there that worked for me, it was in good hands
mm-hmm.
if they were doing the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Then it would be up to the company to change it.
Mm-hmm.
But it only lasted another 2 years and a half
after you left.
I was really surprised. Now, I could comment on reasons for retirement, or reasons for collapse,
mm-hmm.
and say the company should have been operating yet. because you more than likely knew Charles Chamberlain, Representative Chamberlain in Congress.
Yes, I remember.
And Charles Chamberlain was my idea of a champion for Rio. He stood up for us in a lot of things. We were in government business, and we were in certain classifications of debt, maybe two, because we built a lot of government contracts and trucks for the Army. And if he'd still been in office, then Rio was in that, I think they owed the government, I think, something like $5 million.
Oh, my.
Well, $5 million, if you look at it today, is
not
is
that a, much.
It's just a pittance.
It's hard to imagine that, but I guess you're right.
And I think he would have went to bat and said, look, they're in reorganization,
mm-hmm.
and I think they can make a go. I think they would have had a stay, and I think Rio could have reorganized
mm-hmm.
and been operating.
Yeah, and it would have been better for the community.
The community needed a job, right? Because at that time, Claire Laudenstalger was down there. He was in charge of all of material handling in the plant,
mm-hmm.
and I think Claire was a very efficient man in material handling. He'd done it for years, and he should know. He had a bunch of people that swore by him.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it was a question out there in the factory of not being able to move the material.
Yeah.
And the factory possibly in some ways was antiquated, could have been updated with a lot newer equipment. I think even Louis Garcia might have told you that.
Pointed that out to us.
So if you don't keep up with the...
But Rio was not the only one guilty of that in those days.
No, Rio was getting down pretty low on some of their machinery, was getting pretty well worn and needed replacement. Naturally, that costs money.
Right.
But I do think if Charles Chamberlain would have still been in Congress
mm-hmm.
at that time, I think he would have seen the handwriting on the wall and would have argued
for the
holding off of the debt until reorganization was mm-hmm. and got an operating and see how it can go. We lose money every day in the government through foolishness. That wouldn't have been foolish.
I'm a little hazy on why Rio owed the government $5 million. Was it because they couldn't fulfill Army contracts?
It might have been Army contracts and things like that, but of course I didn't get into the finance. If I was doing that, I'd possibly set in Glenn Whistler's job when he was secretary or treasurer of the county, and then Bob Darrow when he was, and people like that, but I didn't sit in their chair, and right. Finance on that end of it wasn't my problem. The only thing is, when I was an exporter, of course, I had to think about financing of contracts, but they came through a letter of credit. Until I could see a letter of credit, I couldn't firmly put the order in.
Mm-hmm.
Because of foreign countries, unless they could get the letter of credit
to get it
up front, you didn't dare start work on it because you didn't know whether you would be left with it. Unless it was a standard model coming off the line every day. A lot of foreigners had different, we even had right-hand drive and so on.
Oh, right.
Which I don't think is a bad idea. And that gets us back to Japan.
Yeah.
If we could have built right-hand drives for foreign market, we could build them for the Japanese market.
Sure.
It's your business to conform to their market.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what they do with us.
Rather than their market to conform to your product.
That's right. Yeah.
Let's put responsibility where responsibility belongs.
Yeah. Can I switch the topic? Do you have any more questions about this? Because I just want to switch it a little bit.
Go ahead and ask me anything.
Okay. I'm also interested more in the personal side a little bit too. About you.
Right.
And I'm interested if you lived in Lansing the whole time that you were working in Rio.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
You were part of the Lansing community.
Yeah. Now, when I went to work for Rio, I was in a housekeeping room first. I told me. We got there. We had a home. We rented a house on Alpha Street,
mm-hmm.
1708 Alpha Street. That's just south of Mount, just north of Mount Hope, between there and almost down to Baker Street. But there's that where they had the skating rink.
We
just lived
south
of that.
Sure.
On Alpha Street, the first street. East of Pennsylvania,
mm-hmm.
Lindbergh Park there.
Sure, I know exactly what it is. Yeah,
lived in 1708 Alpha Street
for
quite a long time. And I used to walk to work, go out and walk over Baker Street, which I think a lot of Rio employees had a path worn over that. And I'd go in through the engineering building and walk through the plant to get to my office right over on Washington.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd done that a lot. The weather was inclement, that's when I'd go over. I had a parking spot down there before, so I didn't have to worry about that either, parking. Then I and the wife, after a while, we was scouting around and we went out to Ravenswood. That's just north of Willow, east of Waverly. And the Ravenswood subdivision was in that little corner, in the northeast corner between it. And I lived on Ravenswood. We had a house. It was being built. We didn't order it. But when I liked it, we bought it.
Great.
And we lived at 1512 Ravenswood for, about 26, 27 years. And I sold it and moved to Texas.
Oh.
I sold the house in 87.
Oh.
And then moved to San Antonio, Texas.
Hmm.
Now, don't get me wrong. We moved back to Lansing.
I guess so, otherwise you wouldn't be sitting in front of us.
But that becomes a good story too. Of course, we moved to Texas because we'd traveled all over the country. We thought, well, that'd be a nice place to live.
Yeah.
And my wife's brother runs a chain of liquor stores in Texas, the biggest chain in Texas. Don's and Ben's Liquors, if you ever go to San Antonio.
What's
the name of it? Don's and Ben's.
Don
is living, Ben died.
Mm-hmm.
But it's still run on
Don's
and Ben's liquor barns or liquor stores, and they have 23 of them.
Wow.
And all in San Antonio or in the barns around. So we went down there, and we lived there for 2 years. The only thing about it, it's a beautiful town, beautiful city, lots to see. In fact, I'd advise anybody to go and tour and see the sights.
Sure, the old historic
thing. It's a beautiful river town, and there's something on the river to see, and lots of other things too. But when it gets hot, after fiesta time comes just about in April, that's San Jacinto Day, and that is in about the middle of April. My birthday's in the middle of April, but the 15th.
Tax day.
And that, there's another little story. But we We moved down there, we liked it, we had a beautiful apartment, just about the same as we got here. And, but it gets hot, say about the 1st of May. It's going to get hot, and it's going to stay hot. And it's going to stay hot until at least the middle of October.
Oh,
and if you've done any walking, and I and the wife love to walk, and we walk, a lot of times we walk from our place near Canal Road to the mall and back, maybe 2 times a week. In the wintertime, maybe not quite, but once a week, we do it Sunday. And we go on the walks that are held by the state and by the counties here and do that just for recreation. And so we decided to move back to Lansing. And of course, we like to play bridge, and we couldn't find anybody to play bridge in San Antonio.
Oh, dear.
Nobody likes to play bridge down there. I don't know. They play golf, and I don't know. I played golf a few times with my brother-in-law down there in the midsummer. And boy, I tell you, they're glad to get back to the clubhouse.
Oh, it's cool.
Yeah, boy, I tell you. Mm. And, well, we moved back because of the extreme temperatures.
Yeah. Yeah.
Now, we might have done better if we had decided to move maybe to Arkansas or southern Kentucky or Tennessee and split the difference with them, or go to North Carolina, where our daughter is. She's in Rockingham, North Carolina. So we moved back. The house is sold. We go by it once in a while and look at it with envy.
Oh, sure.
But
yeah,
then,
you're pretty close to paying it off, too.
And somebody said not too long ago in the paper, says, well, when you get to your 70s, you might still be able to do all that yard work, but you might be better thinking about an apartment if you can afford it. Get rid of all this trouble. Well, that may be true, but it's only been this last year that I've been affected with this arthritis, which is kind of slowing me down.
Mm-hmm.
It takes away all of my craft. See, I like to work in the shop and do things.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, that's what my hobby is woodworking.
Mm-hmm.
I built cedar chests for both of my granddaughters, and I built a nice big cabinet for my grandson.
Mm-hmm. Now you said your kids went to MSU, you were telling me that?
Yeah, now my daughter graduated from high school with high honors and also out of Michigan State with high honors.
Mm-hmm.
And my son done the same thing,
mm-hmm.
only he didn't go to Eastern, he went to Sexton. Went to Waverly the final part, but he started in at Sexton. But then when Waverly School out there, when he went to that, he graduated from there with honors, and also in Michigan State. And he took boxing or packaging, but you know, packaging kind of petered out just about the time he graduated.
Oh, it's still going.
Packaging, I know, packaging isn't quite a thing, but it was an awful overload.
Oh, I see. In the field,
yeah. But my daughter, of course, graduated in teaching.
Mm-hmm.
She taught down at Niles, to her teacher,
mm-hmm.
and she's taught in North Carolina. And now she's teaching just older people in Rockingham Tech.
Oh, cool.
Part-time, just people that haven't really got up on their reading, older people that possibly, and a lot of them are colored. Possibly to say they were neglected, but I think primarily they neglected themselves in the latter years.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah.
I don't say a lot of them haven't wanted to get ahead.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe beyond the capacity, but still I don't know that.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't want to even venture again.
Well,
they're both doing very well.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And Rio was an employer that let you take care of your family properly.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
As far as I think, if I look at it two ways, while I was at Rio, I had two back operations.
Oh.
Yes, yeah. In 1954, I had the pricing operation, and I had a bad back. I'd get up and I'd have to hang on to the edge of the desk for 5 minutes before I could get straightened out. In fact, I don't get up too gingerly even now. And I had the first back operation. And Ardith Pappin, who was the head nurse, she's a great lady too. And when I went back, I was holding off 10 days. I go back down there, and I set up the desk and do some work, and then we go down, and she gave me a heat treatment on the back, and I feel pretty good. But in 61, I had another desk room.
Oh, dear.
And they took care of me very well.
Yeah. You had good benefits and good hospital.
Oh, yeah. My Blue Cross Blue Shield at that time took care of me. Mm-hmm.
Oh, of course.
Except for the excess that the specialist wanted on the first one. I had a bill of that I had paid for quite a while. And he was a specialist out of Birmingham, Michigan, Dr. Wood. And he's good. He'd done the second operation, too, but apparently didn't charge so much the second one.
Maybe it wasn't that serious.
Well, it was every bit as serious, but, you know, when you get to the point where I was going around, I had a chair back brace on most of the time. You'd like to be carrying your chair back with you, and it was steel and leather. Keeping you up towards the end, they'd see between 54 and 61, 62, you're talking about 6 years or 7 years. And part of that, my back was deteriorating again, so I wore the brace, finding out to the point where I couldn't even put on my own socks or put on my own underwear, and I thought I was every way to get it taken care of.
So, I just have a few more, about your bathroom and stuff. You mentioned that you were from Duluth, your family was from Duluth. Were they farmers up there, or...?
Well, I was the first child born after we moved off of the homestead at Barn, Minnesota.
Mm-hmm.
And that's 40 miles out of Duluth,
right,
to the west. It's on the main highway 35 going down to Minneapolis.
Mm-hmm.
And my older brother was dead now, but he was born in Farnham and I was born in Duluth, and we're 2 years apart.
Mm-hmm.
So, I was born actually in the railroad, almost in the railroad yard.
Oh, my.
Yeah, they showed me the old shed that was still there when I got old enough to know it was used as a tool shed for the Northern Pacific Railroad.
Oh, my.
The house I was born in, right down by the railroad track. Back in those days, of course, Duluth was all based on lumber. Lumber and the iron ore coming off the Mesaba Range. And so it was, let's just say, a good life. As a kid, I sold papers and had a lot of
fun. Did your dad work with the lumber industry?
Well, at one time, he was a timber cruiser.
Oh.
But that went out and marked ones for cutting in certain tracks. He knew which ones should be cut and which shouldn't. But then he went to work for Scott Graff Lumber Company in Duluth, which is a sawmill right down, I'd say possibly half a mile from where I was born.
Mm-hmm.
And he worked for half a mile. And then after a while, that kind of petered out and went to work for grocery home once.
Oh, okay.
But I learned all of the techniques of farming as far as that's concerned from people I worked for. I could help cows with the best of them. And I mean milk, I don't mean food.
On the machine, right.
In fact, I worked for a dairy farm for a while in Duluth because I needed something to do. And it was only about 10 miles out of town.
Mm-hmm.
And I milked 21 cows morning and night.
Wow.
And he had a herd of about 100. So mm-hmm. his boys, there was 10 hunters. So they knew how to work. And then I run the milk.
Mm-hmm.
In the daytime, after the first milking, get back in time to start cleaning udders and get ready to milk for the evening.
Now, a lot of the people that we've talked to, not necessarily gone through extensive interviews, but still just talked to who were involved with the Rio, came from farming backgrounds.
Oh, yeah. I would
or
say
still
I
even lived on the farm.
Yeah, all right. I would say in this area, possibly, because this town has grown quite a bit since then, and even since I came here in 41, it's grown. In fact, I remember coming up here about the only place you could get an apartment was Hillcrest.
Oh,
And these shines about the only apartments that were in this town.
That's where my husband lived before, yeah.
In fact, Bill Summers, one of his personnel directors, he lived in Hillcrest while he was out there.
Nice place.
So, it's a small town, it's a small world too, and you stop thinking of all the expenses and things.
Sure.
I don't know if there's anything else.
I just have one more thing. I wanted to know if you were a part of that, the steering gear.
Oh yeah, so Now, okay. All right, now there in itself is quite a thing. That we were all, that's where all supervisors, originally
right.
It was strictly supervisor.
Right.
Then they got down to subforeman and so forth, and that was always a great deal.
Mm-hmm.
As you know, I worked for the March of Darkness for years.
Right.
In fact, Harry Olson never got me into that. That's why I mentioned it. And the expert in government sales. And he got me into the March of Dimes. And shortly after the epidemic, see, I had come up here in 41, but he had been here before that, when the epidemic was on in the 30s, late 30s.
The polio?
When polio was on. And I grew up, got right into the middle of it. In fact, I handled all the troughs on the streets and in the theaters for a long time.
Oh, boy.
With
the money was collected.
Yeah. Functions. I was chairman of the board for a couple of years, for the independent board.
Mm-hmm.
And
this was through steering gear? People were involved in that through that?
And the steering gear people weren't involved in that.
Okay.
Not in the March of Dimes. But we went to ball meetings, and we all went to a ball meeting during the summer. We're too